If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston. We're in a very unusual place an important day.
This is where I actually started my media career, Television Centre. Back when I was 19, I came here to do an interview about being a woman in engineering. That's what set off the whole thing. But today...
We're right next to the donor, aren't we? Is what we used to call the BBC offices, which are now lavish flats. But next to it are all these historic studios that the BBC occupied for donkey's years. All the famous programmes that we all knew and love over many years were made here. And they are still in use. And I make my show, The Peston Show, here, which is why we are here on Budget Day, squeezing in a bit of chat about what was quite an interesting budget.
Yeah, it was so rowdy though, wasn't it? Like the Deputy Speaker had to like interrupt 8 times to stop everyone shouting. It got to a point where I was like, I cannot actually hear what the policies are because everyone is just shouting over each other.
There was a bit of that. I mean, you can tell that there's a bit of election fever around the place and everybody's slightly on edge and slightly sort of geeing themselves up for what will be a year of political battle. And, you know, like many elections, but I think this one is going to be more of this than normal. You know, it'll be about the economics. It'll be about living standards. And so the big judgment today is the extent to which the Chancellor has done enough to make people feel that he's got a plan to fix what has been, you know, years now of economic crisis.
And I should say in front of you is the actual red book itself with Spring Budget 2024 written on it. There was nothing in there, though, we didn't really know already, was there? There was no surprises. I think everything you've been pretty much saying and others have been saying on the telly over the last and radio and wherever else over the last couple of days is what we did actually hear from the Chancellor in terms of, you know, the cut in national insurance. They were listening to us, obviously, about the British ISA, which I know we're going to talk about in the next show. But there was no shocks, were there?
There weren't any significant shocks, as you say. In fact, in the run-up to it, probably the biggest shock was that the central tax cut was, you know, leaked and confirmed, which is sort of extraordinary. I mean, in the old days, when there was a big budget leak, heads would roll. This stuff was supposed to be confidential. But we knew for an absolute racing certainty yesterday that national insurance was going to be cut by 2 pence in the pound. And, you know, the Chancellor didn't look as though he was going to take responsibility for a leak and didn't look as though he was somebody who was minded to resign. These sorts of leaks are now par for the course in our politics. It's all about, you know, conditioning expectations. So they get sort of 2 days of what they think was good news.
Isn't it a way of like testing it as well to see what the reaction is? So then you can, you know, work out whether people are going to take this positively and then go on from there.
Yeah. I mean, look, in terms of testing it out, the audience that was most important to him were his own MPs who wanted an income tax cut because they don't think that the punters out there, most British people, know what national insurance really is. Mm. And actually, in the old days, I remember when Gordon Brown actually put up national insurance to fund the health service, a huge increase in health service spending back, I think this was about 2003. One of the reasons they chose national insurance is because even though they billed it as you're making a contribution to save the health service, as it were, it probably didn't feel as painful, they thought, to British people as putting up income tax. So there is this idea that somehow we don't get national insurance, but, you know, in simple terms, and you know this because we've been immersed in this stuff forever, you know, if you're in work, you know, a national insurance increase of a penny in the pound is more or less exactly the same in terms of its impact as a, you know, a penny on income tax, the basic rate, and indeed knocking it off, you know, has the same effect. The big difference, and I'd be interested to know whether you think this matters to many British people or matters to the economy. The big difference is when you cut national insurance, it only affects people in work. It doesn't give anything if you're a pensioner, because if you're a pensioner, you don't pay national insurance. And if your income comes from rents, or if it comes from investments, if it comes from your savings, again, you don't get any benefit. Whereas if you cut income tax, and you're getting your income from all these other sources, it does benefit you. So, do you think it's a good thing?
Well, yeah, because it's seen, isn't it? He kept talking about is that this is a double taxation for people who are in work, who, as you say, pay both national insurance and income tax. But I guess...
But what do you think, though? Do you think he was wrong to focus the tax cut just on people in
work? Well, his big thing is getting people back into work, isn't it? That's the thing. It's this 10 million adults of working age who currently aren't working. So his big focus, and I think a lot of the initiatives, like, you know, we'll probably talk about the child benefit tapering and that change on the threshold there, is all about getting people who are reluctant to work back into work if they can. And so this is part of that, isn't it?
And the OBR says it may increase work if you include also the 2p in the pound cut in national insurance that you did in the autumn.
Yeah.
They're talking about employment creation of about 200,000.
How do they work that out though? So how do they, because that's like, you've got to understand the psyche of people who are considering going into work, aren't you? You know, there's 200,000 people that's been predicted who are likely to take up some of these 900,000 vacancies that we've got across the UK economy. And this idea it's going to add 0.4% to GDP. How on earth do they work that out? Because then there's like working out, if I went round and said to people who weren't in work, right, there's going to be this bit of a cut in how much national insurance you pay. Will you now go out and get a job? Is that what's going to make the difference? I don't know, because all of the skill shortages and things, all of the gaps we have in and the vacancies, a lot of them are in areas where people aren't trained in those areas. They're just not going to suddenly magic up, are they? So I don't see how this will definitely lead to all of these jobs. Like the prediction from the October cut, when that first 2p in the pound cut we had from national insurance that was announced in October, it came into effect in January this year. The prediction is that'll add 94,000 jobs. It's a prediction though, isn't it? It's being talked about as if that actually happened, but it hasn't yet.
No, it hasn't happened. And look, just to be clear, you know, the OBR think they have sophisticated models of the way that the economy works, you know, as all, you know, sensible economic forecasters would claim. But they would also say, because I think these people are on the whole, well, actually some of them are a bit arrogant, but actually I think the OBR is fairly self-deprecating. I think that, you know, they would say, you know, this is a forecast. And, you know, first of all, they would accept that when you've got a model, you're constantly refining it on the basis of the evidence that emerges. It's never a perfect model of how the economy functions. And then secondly, you know, there are lots of things that can go wrong along the way that they haven't factored into their calculations, which could knock them off course. All they're really saying, which I think is sort of basic common sense, that if you cut the cost of employing people and reducing taxation does cut the cost of employing people,
yeah,
then it's a reasonable argument to say that more people will be employed, because for an employer, you know, the cost of employing those people has gone down.
But the problem alongside this is the fact that they're not changing the tax thresholds until 2028. So what you've got that fiscal drag, haven't you, where each year more people are going to end up in the next tax band just as their wage naturally increases because of, you know, if it's pay linked to inflation or whatever else, they're going to move into those higher tax bands. So therefore, they're going to be paying more tax. So they might get this short term feeling in it on April the 6th when it happens and national insurance comes down, which is very handy for any upcoming elections that might be happening. But in the longer term, this isn't going to be a tax cut, really, is it?
You've made an important point, which is that the tax burden is still rising despite today's cuts in the national insurance rates because of that hugely important decision that Jeremy Hunt made to freeze the tax thresholds for all those years. And that generates an enormous amount of additional taxation for the government because people's wages go up. It takes them from the basic rate tax band to the higher rate tax band. And that generates, as I say, billions for the government. And so even with today's tax cuts, this is a government that is taking the overall burden of taxation in the economy to pretty close to a post-war record. That is a level of taxation as a share of national income that is higher than at any point for at least 75 years. And, you know, that is one of the things that is driving Jeremy Hunt's Tory colleagues slightly batty, because the Tories are supposed to be the party of low taxation. And since they've been in power since 2010, you know, particularly since COVID and all the rest of it, taxes have just got higher and higher as a share of the economy. And if you're a Tory, you think, oh my God, we're doing the reverse of what we believe in.
There's absolutely loads to get through here, but let's have a quick break.
Spring is a time of renewal. So why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Are you looking for a view of the world that's a bit different? Hi, I'm Jason Palmer, a host of The Weekend Intelligence, a podcast from The Economist. Join us to hear the stories that matter most to our correspondents and editors. Every Saturday, we introduce you to people and ideas that take you outside the ordinary and expand your horizons one episode at a time. Join us and see the world from a new perspective. To listen free until May 31st, search Spotify for The Weekend Intelligence.
You know, I've spent the last couple of weeks with a lot of business people at various different events and conferences and things. And do you know, it's been interesting how little the budget's been really talked about this time. You know, normally there's a lot of chat of what's happening in the budget. Feels like, you know, people care less, probably because of, you know, the upcoming election and the fact that things are going to change. But I mean, have you been chatting to any of them since this has come out?
Well, I had a very amusing encounter this afternoon when I went to see the Chancellor. I was in a builder's merchants off the Old Kent Road in South London. It's called Selco.
And was he in there getting a few bits?
And I mean, obviously, the metaphor for the interview was supposed to be, I presume, getting Britain back to work. That's why you're surrounded by, you know, all your industrial wipes and, you know, your bin bags and your shelving units. But I was having a chat actually to one of the bosses of this business, and you know, he said that, I mean, he was making no bones about it, for him, business conditions in this country are as bad as he has ever known. There is just not enough construction activity going on. You know, his is a business, the Selco business, it's really dependent on people having enough money to build extensions to their homes or doing up their homes. Or, you know, he was just saying, look, nobody's got enough money in their pocket at the moment. We will survive as a business because they're very prudently run. But, you know, within, he said, his industry, you know, and he's been in it for 30, 40 years, he's literally never known it as bad. And he said, you know, yes, the national insurance cut will help a bit on the margin. He did not believe that it was going to transform their prospects.
I think the other thing as well is it's the constant change, isn't it? So I was with Make UK that represents manufacturers last week. They got a mention in the budget when Jeremy Hunt was talking. And one of the things that's really kind of done for manufacturing is all the constant changes in policy. So they were saying there's been something like 26 changes in corporation tax just in this parliament, which is, you know, incredible. And even earlier, you know, I was talking to one of my friends who runs a business who's saying that this national insurance change means the payroll's got to change again. Like, and they've, you know, all the big companies will be fine. They've got automated software that can do it. But for the smaller ones, you know, it changed in January. Now it's changing in April. How many times are things going to keep changing? And it's hard for them to, that's manpower spent on sorting it out. Then there'll probably be things that will go wrong or whatever that they'll need to deal with. There is that sense that there's still so much change and uncertainty. It is very hard, like your builders merchant was saying, to do business at the moment. It doesn't feel like it's an economy that's, or a government or whoever that's supporting business. And that's the hard thing for them to take, isn't it?
Yeah, he also told me a very funny story. So Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt turned up and he said they were, what they like to do on these occasions, I've witnessed this loads of times, politicians gather the sort of workforce together. And he said, it's absolutely hilarious that, you know, Rishi in particular says, we've given you all this money today, lads. You must be very happy. And basically, although they're polite, they didn't say anything rude. They just, I mean, most of them in the room, he said, didn't even know what had happened in the budget.
Yeah, of course.
They looked at him slightly blankly. But this is, I'm afraid, the...
That's so cringe.
Anyway.
Do you know what? It reminds me, though, talking of funny stories. Do you remember the time? I can't remember which budget in particular it was, but it was Alistair Darling, the late Alistair Darling, who was Chancellor at the time. And I was your producer. So what we'd do on budget days, we'd decamp to Westminster, wouldn't we, into the Milbank offices then when we were working for the BBC, and set up there. There was a bit of power sharing going on with Nick Robinson. I always remember that. That was quite funny. And about who'd got the office and everything else. And then we went to do the interview at number 11 and you sat down to do the interview. I don't think you remember this, but I remember thinking this is one of the cleverest ways of like disarming a chancellor I'd ever seen. And basically you sat down and you were like, Steph, have you got my pen? And I was like, oh, you need a pen. And I was like, and you went, no, my pen. And I was like, your lucky pen. Yeah.
Oh,
and then you were like, my lucky pen. To which point the chancellor's just sat there looking at you going, he needs a pen. And I'm like, I know, I've got a pen. And then you said to me, can you find out where it is? Is this actually a really important pen to me? So I was like, yes. So then I rang the Milbank offices. I went, I think Peston's losing it, but please, can you find me this pen? And then we found it anyway. I think it was in Nick Robinson's office. So I don't know whether it got moved in or not. Well, I don't know. But then when you started the interview, the Chancellor was just like, I mean, Alistair was just like, what has gone on? And it totally threw him and it was brilliant because then you just skewered him. And I was like, wow, right, I'll have to remember that if I ever do this job.
It was obviously all a cunning plan. Yeah. What a lovely man Alistair Darling was, though. He really
was. Yes, he was, wasn't he?
We miss him. So the interesting thing on these occasions is obviously talking to a chancellor about something he appears to have changed his mind on. So one of the things that they did today was they nicked Rachel Reeves' probably most important tax policy, which was to scrap the tax breaks for so-called non-DOMs. Non-DOMs are these individuals from abroad who come and work here, and under the non-DOM rules, they are exempt from paying UK tax on their overseas earnings. And I've spoken to the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, about this in the past, and he's always said, well, the point about the non-DOM arrangement is it means talented people come to this country, they, you know, pay tax here on what they earn here, and many of them are entrepreneurial or have got skills we need, and we need to have them come to this country because they help the economy to grow, they help to create value for the UK and pay, and, you know, that's a good thing. So up to now, they've been massively defending this system, a system, as we all know, the Prime Minister's wife. Benefits from, as somebody who's an heiress worth something like £700 million, we think. But today, they abolished this non-dom tax break and are putting in place a new arrangement, which will basically give tax breaks to people who come and work here for, I think it was a maximum of 4 years, he said. And after that, they have to pay UK tax. So this is a huge change, right? And there were two things that are, I thought, significant in a political sense. One is, in the past, he said it would damage the economy. And he obviously doesn't think that anymore. And the second thing he said is, if you abolish it, you know, Labour's assuming it's going to raise way more money than it will actually raise. Well, today they said it would raise about 3 billion quid, which is actually more than Labour has recently been saying it would raise. So I said to him repeatedly, you got this wrong. He's a very charming man, Jeremy Hunt. He somehow couldn't bring himself to say that in the past he made a mistake, but he just said, you know, we've been thinking about this for quite a long time. And, you know, actually one of his heroes, Nigel Lawson, back in the 1980s, would have wanted to abolish it, but he didn't. And, you know, he was trying to sort of root himself in the great Tory tradition. But let's be absolutely clear, this is a big and slightly humiliating U-turn for the Tories. But although it is a U-turn for them, it's also a problem for Labour because, you know, Labour has said in terms, Rachel Reeves has said in terms, she won't spend money that, you know, she can't prove is being covered by taxes being raised. Basically, the Chancellor today spent the 2 to 3 billion she was banking on. So if she's, so her public service plans, her public spending plans require her now to find 2 to 3 billion pounds somewhere else. And we don't know at the moment where on earth she's going to find that money.
Yeah, that is very underhand, isn't it? But in the given where the climate we're in at the moment in the run-up to an election, I'm not surprised they're trying to do that. I mean, the thing is, the other problem that, of course, Rachel Reeves is going to have if she does become like the first, you know, female chancellor, is this, it's a terrible inheritance, however you look at it, isn't it? Not just the non-dom stuff, it's just everything at the moment.
There is, and there was a sort of quite significant sleight of hand going on because we already knew that it was going to be massively tight when it comes to funding public services for whoever wins the next election. But to be clear, I think Jeremy Hunt has made it even more difficult. What he's done, which the OBR pointed out, is he said, which most people would agree is a good thing, that he's going to allocate £900 million on average a year to all sorts of projects, particularly IT projects, you know, artificial intelligence projects, digital projects of various sorts, to make the public services more
efficient, yeah.
Right? And, you know, if they can be more productive, you know, that's great, okay? I mean, I said to him, actually, when I interviewed him, I said, look, the history of the public sector making IT investments is pretty awful. I only have to say the words post office and Horizon to you to realize that we do not have a great track record in this country of those sorts of investments. But what the OBR pointed out, and it wasn't in his speech, is that the 900 million a year that's going into these productivity investments is matched by, it says, 800 million reductions in day-to-day spending allocations, which comes on top of, anyway, you know, a framework, what's called an envelope for public spending, which is the headline level, it's a called a 1% increase in inflation-adjusted terms every year. The way to understand that is that given that there are these huge departments, health, schools, defense, overseas aid, where the budgets are either protected or have been promised increases, there are all sorts of public services, justice being an obvious one, local government being another, where on the basis of these plans that have been set out, there would be cuts in real terms, that's inflation adjusted, of 2.3% every year for the lifetime of the next parliament.
Is this on the basis then of productivity going up?
No. He's hoping. So Jeremy Hunt is hoping that productivity will rise so much so that in the end, that squeeze won't mean much worse public services. But my point is productivity can't go up that fast. So basically what all of these plans are predicated on is the idea that you can go into a period of what you know, is frankly austerity on steroids for a number of public services. And the truth is, nobody believes, absolutely nobody believes that's realistic. They don't believe any government, whether it's a Tory government or a Labour government, would, after the election, be able to impose cuts on that level. And therefore, the question is whether these tax cuts are remotely realistic or sustainable. And, you know, broadly, I think it's perfectly reasonable on the basis of the figures that were laid out today to assume that whoever wins the election, whether it's Labour or the Tories, taxes are going to have to go up. They'll both lie. Let's be absolutely clear. Both parties will lie about it, right? In the run-up to the election, they will both say taxes are not going to go up.
But they'll because have
they,
to.
But they have to. Otherwise, our public sector is going to fall apart.
I do not like the idea of austerity on steroids. That does not sound good. Robert, I know you're going off to interview Rachel Reeves now, aren't you? So we're going to wrap things up. We're going to have a look, aren't we, in further detail on all of this. Let the dust settle, I mean, and then come back to you.
It's really interesting thing. Yeah. So, you know, there are, you mentioned them earlier, he's increased the amount that you can save in an ISA.
Yes, we want to talk about that.
If you put your money into British shares, he's putting pressure on pension funds to invest more in British companies. He's reduced the rate of capital gains tax if you sell your house.
Yeah, he's increased the VAT threshold for businesses, small businesses as well. And
there's just a ton of stuff,
yeah,
of, you know, that's going to affect you, whether, you know, you run a business or just in your everyday life. Yeah. And we're going to really get into that tomorrow,
yes,
aren't we?
I'm really interested in the child benefit increase threshold.
About that. I know. Really
important. We will talk about that tomorrow, the impact that could have on business too. Right, let's wrap things up. Good luck with Rachel Reeves. We'll be back. But that's it from The Rest Is Money. If you want to contact us, it's restismoney@gmail.com, or you can message us through our socials. Just search The Rest Is Money. But that's it from us. Jonathan Ross is on above us in a moment, apparently. I might go and watch that while you go interview Rachel Reeves.
I mean, it'll be much, much less entertaining than watching my show, obviously. Yeah. But it's a huge crowd outside. I wonder who's on the Ross show tonight.
I wonder if it's your frenemy. Is it a frenemy now? Because Justin Timberlake, tell us his story when you turned him down for a selfie.
Yeah, everybody's told me I was a total wally about this. But anyway,
I'd have gone for a more insulting
word. It was a couple of weeks ago. He was on the Graham Norton show, which also records in these studios. I was rushing upstairs, actually, because my show was about to start. And I walked past him and he was doing a selfie for, I assume, somebody who works here. And he catches my eye and he says, "Do you want to have a selfie with me?" And I just beamed at him and said, "Look, I'm really sorry. I'd love to, but I'm in too much of a hurry. Bye-bye." And anyway,
I just don't believe this. Like, it's just, why did
anyway,
he ask you?
anyway, he has these minders all around him. And I could just tell that nobody ever says no to a selfie with Justin Timberlake. So anyway, I felt a bit bad about it. And everybody afterwards said I was a total wally and I should have got it, posted it and promoted the Rest Is Money with the pick. So sorry, guys. Yeah. Sorry, Steph.
Yeah, well, cry me a river, Robert.
I'm sure he's crying a river over not having a picture with me. Definitely.
Right, we need to go. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.